Okay, let the adventure continue. Chapter 2. When David's time to die drew near, he charged his son Solomon, saying, I am about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong, be courageous, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. Then the Lord will establish his word that he spoke concerning me. If your heirs take heed to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and with all their soul, there shall not fail you a successor on the throne of Israel. Moreover, you know also what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me, how he dealt with the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner, son of Ner, and Amasa, son of Jether, whom he murdered, retaliating in time of peace for blood that had been shed in war, and putting the blood of war on the belt around his waist and on the sandals of his feet. Act therefore according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace. Deal loyally, however, with the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table. For with such loyalty they met me when I fled from your brother Absalom. There is also with you Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjaminite from Bahurim, who cursed me with a terrible curse on the day when I went to Mahanaim. But when he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, I will not put you to death with the sword. Therefore do not hold him guiltless, for you are a wise man. You will know what you ought to do with him, and you must bring his gray head down with blood to Sheol. Then David slept with his ancestors and was buried in the city of David. The time that David reigned over Israel was 40 years. He reigned 7 years in Hebron and 33 years in Jerusalem. So Solomon sat on the throne of his father David, and his kingdom was firmly established. Then Adonijah, son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother. She asked, Do you come peaceably? He said, Peaceably. Then he said, May I have a word with you? She said, Go on. He said, You know that the kingdom was mine, and that all Israel expected me to reign. However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. And now I have one request to make of you. Do not refuse me. She said to him, Go on. He said, Please ask King Solomon, he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife. Bathsheba said, Very well. I will speak to the king on your behalf. So Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him on behalf of Adonijah. The king rose to meet her and bowed down to her. Then he sat on his throne and had a throne brought for the king's mother, and she sat on his right. Then she said, I have one small request to make of you. Do not refuse me. And the king said to her, Make your request, my mother, for I will not refuse you. She said, Let Abishag the Shunammite be given to your brother Adonijah as his wife. King Solomon answered his mother, And why do you ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom as well, for he is my elder brother. Ask not only for him, but also for the priest Abiathar, and for Joab, son of Jeruthiah. Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, So may God do to me, and much also, for Adonijah has devised this scheme at the risk of his life. Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and placed me on the throne of my father David, and who has made me a house as he promised, today Adonijah shall be put to death. So King Solomon sent Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and struck him down, and he died. The king said to the priest Abiathar, Go to Anathoth, your estate, for you deserve death. But I will not at this time put you to death, because you carried the ark of the Lord God before my father David, and because you shared in all the hardships my father endured. So Solomon banished Abiathar from being priest to the Lord, thus fulfilling the word of the Lord that he had spoken concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. When the news came to Joab, for Joab had supported Adonijah, though he had not supported Absalom, Joab fled to the tent of the Lord and grasped the horns of the altar. When it was told King Solomon, Joab has fled to the tent of the Lord and is now beside the altar, Solomon sent Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, saying, Go, strike him down. So Benaiah came to the tent of the Lord and said to him, The king commands, come out. But he said, No, I will die here. Then the Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, "Thus said Joab, and thus he answered me." The king replied to him, Do as he has said. Strike him down and bury him, and thus take away from me and from my father's house the guilt for the blood that Joab shed without cause. The Lord will bring back his bloody deeds on his own head, because without the knowledge of my father David, he attacked and killed with the sword two men more righteous and better than himself, Abner, son of Ner, commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa, son of Jether, commander of the army of Judah. So shall their blood come back on the head of Joab and on the head of his descendants forever. But to David and to his descendants and to his house and to his throne there shall be peace from the Lord forevermore." Then Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, went up and struck him down and killed him, and he was buried at his own house near the wilderness. The king put Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, over the army in his place, and the king put the priest Zadok in the place of Abiathar. Then the king sent and summoned Shammai and said to him, "Build yourself a house in Jerusalem and live there, and do not go out from there to any place whatever. For on the day you go out and cross the Wadi Kidron, know for certain that you shall die. Your blood shall be on your own head." And Shammai said to the king, "The sentence is fair. As my lord the king has said, so will your servant do." So Shammai lived in Jerusalem many days. But it happened at the end of 3 years that two of Shammai's slaves ran away to King Achish, son of Maachai of Gath. When it was told Shammai, "Your slaves are in Gath," Shammai arose and saddled a donkey and went to Achish in Gath to search for his slaves. Shammai went and brought his slaves from Gath. When Solomon was told that Shammai had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and returned, the king sent and summoned Shammai and said to him, "Did I not make you swear by the Lord and solemnly adjure you, saying, 'Know for certain that on the day you go out and go to any place whatever, you shall die'? And you said to me, 'The sentence is fair, I accept.' Why then have you not kept your oath to the Lord and the commandment with which I charged you?" The king also said to Shammai, "You know in your own heart all the evil that you did to my father David, so the Lord will bring back your evil on your own head. But King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever." Then the king commanded Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck him down, and he died. So the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. The word of the Lord? Thanks be to God. Okay, so David's about to die, and he gives a little farewell speech. This is sort of patterned after Moses passing the torch on to Joshua, which you can read about in Deuteronomy chapter 33. It's also somewhat similar to Joshua's own death scene in chapter 3 of the book named after him, as well as the prophet Samuel's in 1 Samuel chapter 23. They admonish the people who will be left behind to stay faithful to the covenant with God. And in this instance, David gives Solomon some instructions on how to consolidate his power by liquidating his enemies. And basically this focuses on the people who had supported Adonijah's claim to the throne, which we talked about last week in chapter 1. But there's more to it than just that. There are some really old scores that we see cropping up motivating this slaughter. This offends our sense of morality. I mean, it's just nasty. One could argue that royal successions throughout history, even till relatively recently, have involved a lot of bloodshed. But just because it's normal doesn't mean it's right. But there's a consistent theme throughout 1 and 2 Kings that God accomplishes his purpose through flawed and sinful human actions, including violence. And this is a difficult theology for us to square with the revelation of God we've been given in Jesus Christ, who, apart from overchanging the money tables in the temple and some harsh words he had for his disciples and for his opponents, practiced nonviolence. But there was violence in that story, and the violence occurred on the cross. If God was willing to allow his own son to be killed in order for the salvation of humanity, it's not too terribly difficult to see how God in order to provide for the succession he desired from David to Solomon, would not only allow but encourage the purging of any potential threat to Solomon's reign. So David provides justification for killing Joab the general on the fact that something that happened a long time ago, you can read about it in 2 Samuel. This is in your notes. I'm just doing this aloud for people who may be listening online. 2 Samuel chapter 3 verses 6 through 39 and also chapter 24 through 10. Abner and Amasa. Abner was in Saul's army, but he defected to David, and David said, fine, I'll give you safe passage into my lines. Joab killed him anyway. He knew about this. He had gotten the order, but apparently Abner had killed Joab's brother. Now, he did it in self-defense, and you can read about this in Samuel chapters 2 and 3. So Joab was seeking vengeance, disobeyed David, and so that's one issue here. It's a little less clear why David was upset about Saul killing Amasa. It's probably simply because Amasa was a rival of Joab. He was a loyal soldier to David. But it's odd, you know, that David would wait this long to get payback on Joab. Joab was just useful. But he also granted him clemency. So it's quite clear that David is instructing Solomon, these are the people you have to get rid of to keep a hold on the throne. You know, this is what's going to provide you with security. And some scholars would argue that the whole reason why this is part of David's death speech, if you will, is that they're trying to shelter Solomon. And he ends up getting all these people killed. But what you can say is Solomon did this because this was his dad's dying wish. Okay? So it gives him a little cover. You know, we saw this in chapter 1. Where Abijah says, I'm king, dad's almost dead. And he was the eldest surviving brother of David from another mother. Solomon's mom, Bathsheba, along with the prophet Nathan, went into the king's bedchamber and sort of planted a false memory in his brain and manipulated him to declare Solomon king. And Solomon is referred to in chapter 1, but he's not doing anything. So we talked last week about how this may have been written in such a way to legitimize Solomon's claim, to not make him appear to be a usurper. And again, we see here maybe trying to shield Solomon from all this sordidness by, you know, constructing a story this is what David's telling him to do, so he's just basically, you know, following his instructions. David also tells Solomon, you need to get rid of Shimei. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. Shimei had cursed David. You can read about this in 2 Samuel chapter 16, verses 5 through 13. Later on, he says he's sorry, and David forgives him. In part because, if you read in 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 11, David says, well, that's pretty unpleasant, but, you know, I could see where God would want you to curse me. And so he forgives him in part because he's like, well, you said what God wanted you to say. But it's also likely that there's some political strategizing going on here. You know, this was at a time when David's reign wasn't really very secure. He needed as much support as he could get. And so by being supportive of Shimei, that sort of helped secure the tribe of Benjamin, who were kind of sitting on the fence. Nevertheless, better safe than sorry. So, son, make sure you kill Shimei. But there's more than just getting rid of your potential opponents. You have to be good to certain people, and that included Barzillai the Gilead. And part of it was gratitude when David's son Absalom made a coup attempt. This family was very supportive, but there's also a literally material reason for this. Barzillai, that name comes from the Hebrew root word for iron, and Gilead had major iron deposits. And what's that useful for? Making swords. Okay? So you've got to be good to your iron supplier. Otherwise, your armory might end up running short. Then David, after one of the most brutal last will and testaments ever delivered, dies. He reigned for 40 years. He was buried in Jerusalem. And it wasn't long before Adonijah shows up at court and goes to Bathsheba instead of Solomon directly, and says, would you go ask your son if I could have Abishag, the Shunammite woman? You might remember her. She's a real looker. She's young. And when dad couldn't stay warm on his deathbed, they brought her in to snuggle with him. You know, in a way, it's kind of an innocent request, but not really. Because back then, to take a woman from the harem of any king, that was it was an audacious maneuver. It would have brought some suspicion. This is a person who still has designs on the throne. And in fact, he says as much. He says, well, you know that, you know, I basically was king for about 2 hours until, you know, David decided different. You know, so this really is just a small favor that I'm asking. And you can see how risky this was. Solomon gets really angry. His favorite hatchet man, Benaiah, he sends him out to off his half-brother, and that's what happens. Benaiah, boy, he is a reliable and ruthless guy. Everybody really needs somebody like that. So next up is Abiathar, the sort of co-high priest with Zadok. He supported Adonijah's claim to the throne, but he wasn't killed. He was just exiled to his estate in Anathoth, which was a fine way to neutralize him. It was only about 3 miles northeast of Jerusalem, so it had been easy for Solomon to keep an eye on him. And, you know, there were reasons for this. When Absalom was trying to overthrow his father David, Abiathar helped his co-priest Zadok carry the Ark of the Covenant back into Jerusalem. You can read all about that in 2 Samuel 15. And, you know, that was helpful. And, you know, you have to be careful with folks who, you know, rate high enough to actually carry the Ark of the Covenant and not die from it. He basically gets thrown out. And in part, you know, it sort of alludes here that, you know, in verse 27, thus fulfilling the word of the Lord that he had spoken concerning the house of Eli and Shiloh. In 1 Samuel chapters 2 and 3, there's an oracle delivered against the house of the prophet Eli. There are a lot of prophecy fulfillments in 1 and 2 Kings, so get used to this. And all of this is to, you know, demonstrate the legitimacy of what the kings are doing, later what the prophets are doing, and above all, what God is doing as this situation, you know, gradually becomes a downward spiral. So Solomon is fulfilling the promises of God and the prophecies about those promises, and that's good. But then when things, you know, really turn for the worst, and you get the sequence of bad kings, and eventually they get conquered and sent off into exile, that's a fulfillment of prophecies as well. But Abiathar, as we talked about in chapter 1, he sort of represents this old guard, the people who had been with David, you know, sort of from the beginning. These were the tabernacle people, not the temple people. So their suppression would have been important because there's going to be a major transition from tabernacle to the temple that Solomon's about to build. And then it's Joab's turn, and he basically imitates his patron Adonijah. holds on to the horns of the altar, claiming sanctuary. It's a good enough claim to protection that the people sent to kill him go back to Solomon twice, asking for further instructions. You know, so he won't come out of the tabernacle. He's got a, you know, white-knuckled grip on the horns of the altar. We're kind of concerned about killing him there, you know, because there are laws about this, and we don't want to defile the altar by shedding human blood on it. And basically Solomon says, hey, there's a loophole. Go back and read Exodus chapter 21, verses 12 through 14. If you're a murderer, and this guy is, because he killed Abner and Amasa, you don't qualify to seek sanctuary on the horns of the altar. And so, once again, Benaiah, who apparently really liked his job, went in and killed Joab where he stood. And then the last one is Shammai. He's basically put under house arrest, so he's on parole. And then if he leaves, he'll be killed. 3 years go by, and a couple of his slaves try to escape. Shammai's told about it. They've gone off to Gath, which is Philistine territory, and Shammai goes to try to reclaim them. Again, something that seems innocent enough, but why didn't Shammai send somebody else? Okay, why did he go himself? And Gath is in the land of the Philistines. So this could have easily been interpreted as sort of sounding out the Philistines to see if maybe they were interested in helping out to overthrow Solomon in preference for somebody else. I mean, we don't know if that was actually Shammai's motive or not. But, you know, if you're King Solomon, you're trying to consolidate the security of your throne, maybe even a little on the paranoid side, and you've told the guy you're under house arrest if you leave, you know what the consequences are. He summons him, reads him the riot act, and then Benaiah offs Shammai. And so at this point, the entire old guard has been either liquidated or neutralized. If you're looking for ethical guidance in this chapter, good luck. But there is the theology here that permeates both books of the Kings, and that is God is going to get done what he wants done, even through some of the worst actions of human beings, actions that we would ordinarily see as sinful, and which very may well, in fact, be sinful. God can work through our sinfulness, through our deficiencies and inadequacies, and that's really the message that's being delivered here. Of course, as the final verse of chapter 2 says, all of this proved to be successful. So the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. So, an exciting chapter, blood-soaked.
Do you think this is where ISIS gets their politics?
Well, yeah, I mean, not just ISIS, but lots of people, you know, radical fundamentalist Christians, very right-wing Orthodox Jews, would look at books like Joshua and Kings and say, as long as we're doing God's will, anything goes. And and of course, Muslims revere Hebrew scripture, what we call the Old Testament. It's not quite as authoritative as the Quran, but the Quran contains similar passages around things like jihad. It's a little ambiguous. Sometimes jihad means actually war against the infidel to convert or kill them, but sometimes jihad means the internal struggle that all people who attempt to be faithful follow in exerting self-control and overcoming their own sinful desires. And so that's part of the challenge of interpretation, you know, applying it to current circumstances is, you know, this was then, and since it is the primary authority for our faith and practice, it also means that this is now. But how do we interpret as Christians through the lens of the New Testament the meaning of 1 Kings chapter 2 for us today. I mean, does it mean that if, you know, we believe that God has ordained that I be in charge of the United States or the planet, you know, I have big aspirations, that, you know, my version of Benaiah can go around killing with impunity to make sure that it happens? I think most people would say probably not. So it's, you know, it's part of the struggle. But we have to affirm that the succession from David to Solomon was divinely decreed, for a particular purpose. And in this case, the end is justified by the means. Yeah, I mean, he turns out to be a really good king. I mean, he built the temple, and when God said, "Ask for whatever you want, and I'll give it to you," he asked for wisdom. You know, he could have asked for riches or the ability to conquer all of his enemies, and which basically would have been the same thing as asking for riches. And God says, "You've chosen wisely," and he was, on balance, a good ruler. But getting there was messy, literally messy. I mean, you got buckets of blood all over the place. Understandably, yeah. Yeah, I have difficulty reading parts of the Old Testament, which is one of the reasons why when everybody's like, "Let's do 1st and 2nd Kings," I was like, "Great." They're fascinating books. They're tales of adventure, and there's much that we can learn about God and about how we're meant to conduct ourselves in our covenant with God in these books. But you know, it's disturbing, really. I mean, because some people would say, "Oh, well, that's the God of the Old Testament." And in the early church, there were some heretics who said that the God of the Old Testament isn't the same God that we see in Jesus. God of the Old Testament, who created the universe and allowed or encouraged people or even commanded people to do all these nasty, ugly, murderous things, that was a demigod, a sort of a junior varsity God who put us in this position. And the real God that we see in Jesus allowed this so that he could sort of come in, swoop in, and rescue us all. There was a heretic called Marcion who basically said Hebrew Scripture is not our Scripture, and every reference to Hebrew Scripture in the books that became the New Testament, because he was operating before the canon was formed, he basically took out. Which, as you know from our study of Mark and Hebrew and Romans, he took out a lot. You know, I mean, basically the Bible he had left, you know, you could, you know, stick in your shirt pocket. And it's not dissimilar from what Thomas Jefferson did when he sort of literally snipped out with scissors all of the supernatural elements in the New Testament and sort of cut and paste in the literal way, and came up with his own Bible. That's what Marcion did. And we have to resist the temptation to succumb to those heresies and just wrestle with these deeply uncomfortable passages. Caroline, then Jim.
Great deal of difficulty reconciling all of this with
they didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And which they twisted around to justify.
That's a great point. I mean, because David starts out by saying, keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, which would have included the Ten Commandments, which includes thou shalt not kill or murder, depending on how you translate the Hebrew. And so he's like, now make sure you do what it says in the Torah and kill all these people. That would be the distinction, that there's a difference between murder, you know, and justice. Because Joab murdered Abner and, Amasa. And, he murdered them. He took their lives unlawfully in contradiction to the orders of his superior. And so they're executing justice. And so I think that would be the distinction. Like if we could bring David and Solomon and Benaiah in here, they would say, we didn't violate the Ten Commandments. These were justified. You know, this wasn't homicide. This was executing a rightfully ordered death sentence. That's what they would have said. Jen?
All this makes me... But
yeah.
Which of the world's religions don't have this awful beginning in the background? I mean, the Buddhists, I've met a bunch of Buddhists in the past few years, and they're very peaceful. They're very nice.
Yeah.
But do all religions have this background, this garbage that they drag behind
them? No. No, they don't. That's a great question. Not all major world religions are historical in the way that the peoples of the book, Judaism, Christians, and Muslims, are historical. So Buddhism is largely an ahistorical tradition. Part of the reason being that the world around us is illusory. And the reason why we suffer is that we're caught up in this illusion, because real reality is something that is above and behind what we ordinarily look at as reality. And, you know, the story is the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, was a very pampered prince, and his father's desire was to prevent him from ever suffering pain and of any kind. And but he was unhappy. Why was he unhappy? Well, he was living in a bubble. It was very artificial. One's desires can never be quenched. And so he snuck out of the palace one day. Are y'all familiar with this story? Am I telling you? Okay. So he snuck out of the palace one day to the town surrounding it, and he saw all of this misery, and it was, of course, a big shock for him. This is everything. Thank you, Peter. This is everything that his dad had tried to protect him from. So he kind of had a crisis, and he snuck out of the palace and left. And he tried to find a way of reconciling this cognitive dissonance. He sought for the truth, and so he sat down under a tree. He stayed there for a really long time. I can't remember how long it was, until he finally found enlightenment. And part of his enlightenment was is that whether you are protected and pampered, or whether you suffer horribly from hunger and disease and exposure, all of it is a lie. What you really have to attune yourself is the true reality. Detach yourself from the realities of the world as we know it, And that's the only way to freedom and peace. So there's no violence in that tradition, but it's an ahistorical tradition. Hinduism does have some violent precursors in it, because it is, to an extent, a historical tradition. Probably the most ancient, enduring religious tradition that we have. It goes back several thousand years, to the best of our knowledge. But their history is more of a mythological history, okay? Whereas Judaism and Christianity and Islam would claim that the books of the Old Testament are an actual history, perhaps with mythological elements in it. And it, that is true. I mean, much of what we read about in books like Samuel and Kings and Chronicles are actual historical events that have been determined by archaeological excavations, by non-biblical contemporaneous sources. Okay. Now, not everything in here is backed up by archaeologists and other texts that were written roughly in the same time period, but enough to show that, yeah, this stuff basically happened. Whereas in Hinduism, it happened so long ago. And for them, it wasn't about a chosen people. It was about a mythological series of events that sort of tried to explain why things were the way they were, how you're meant to exist, but you still see violence. In India, which is a predominantly Hindu country, there are periodic outbreaks of violence between Hindus and Muslims, as well as the Sikhs. The Sikhs are the people who wear the turbans and whatnot. A beautiful religion. It's kind of a blend between Hinduism and Islam. And these outbreaks are justified, not just on cultural or political grounds, but also on religious grounds by all three groups. And you see Buddhists in Myanmar, Burma. You probably read about this in the news. That is a predominantly Buddhist country with a Muslim minority, which is being persecuted by Buddhists. Okay? And there's, you know, they would try to take elements of their tradition to justify what they're doing, although it's very hard to see, essentially, the origin story and the teachings of the Buddha, how you could possibly have any sort of religious justification for what you're doing there in that troubled land. So we do have problems that other major world religious traditions do not. Anybody who's going to exercise violence for whatever reason is going to try to seek their justification in God. You know, if you're just doing what God wants, then whatever you're doing, however awful, you cloak yourself in blamelessness.
It's hopeless.
No, it's not hopeless. It's not hopeless. We have there is hope,
the Reformation, then you could have all kinds of people doing all kinds of things to each other.
Yeah. I mean, even within our own tradition, we've, you know, at the Reformation, the anniversary of which is coming up, I think it's October 30th. I can't remember for sure. I think it's October 30th when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the church, which basically launched the Protestant Reformation. In the centuries afterwards, tremendous conflict between Protestants and Catholics, and we see this in our own origin story as the Episcopal Church, the children of the Church of England. And, you know, you know, go back and forth, Catholic ruler, Protestant ruler, Catholic ruler, Protestant ruler, people getting burned at the stake, getting their heads chopped off because of their religion, and how it was interwoven with, you know, the political realities of the day, because the Pope was a political player, and you had this network of alliances and real complicated stuff. But, you know, that, go ahead. And I would say that almost always, I can't say always, but almost always when people try to justify violence in the name of God, to me that's a violation of the commandment that you shall not take the name of your God in vain.
Time when both sides go to war, they both have their priests praying the same priests of the same religion. I mean, mm-hmm. praying that their army is successful. You know, the German army in the First World War and the British French ally, they were all praying for their God to give them victory. You know?
Yeah.
So it's not, it goes on to this day.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think some people would argue, well, God takes sides and he answered the prayers of the British and the French and the Americans in the First World War. But I think that God's response to both sides was, nobody ever wins a war. You might prevail, but in war there are no winners.
And that just keeps the population down.
What, war?
I'm trying to think of a good reason.
Well, there are good reasons to go to war. In fact, the church has, over the course of its history, has developed something called the just war theory. It's becoming harder to apply in contemporary circumstances because it was generated at the time when wars were quite different. There's something called just cause. Do you have an appropriate reason to go to war? And then there are certain rules around executing war once you get into it. Proportionality is a big one. If someone shells a base, you can't nuke them. That would be a violation of the process of just war as Christians understand it. Just war was developed to provide a framework within which Christians could make choices around wars that involved a couple of sides squaring off along a line, you know, kind of like World War II. And that's not the way war works anymore. So.
I could ask a question that my book refers to the priest who, what's his name?
Abiathar? Or Zadok?
One of Eli's descendants?
Yes.
So David had it in for Eli? Is that?
No, it was, you know, this was practical. You know, we talked last week about how, you know, David, in order to basically hold the kingdom together, he had two generals and he had two high priests. Okay? And this one group, the old guard, you know, Abiathar, Joab, versus, say, Zadok, and I guess the thought was is that since this old guard supported Adonijah, that they just had to go. But it's arguable that this also was a fulfillment of a prophecy in 1 Samuel. It's over in chapters 2 and 3 where God curses the house of Eli, and Abiathar is a descendant of that house, even though he's a priest instead of a prophet. I'm sorry, never mind. Eli was a priest.
27.
Thank you.
It says prophecy against house of Eli.
A man of God came to Eli and said to him, "Thus the Lord has said, I revealed myself to the family of your ancestor in Egypt when they were slaves to the house of Pharaoh. I chose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar, to offer incense, to wear an ephod before me. And I gave to the family of your ancestor all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel. Why then look with a greedy eye at my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded, and honor your sons more than me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel? Therefore the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promise that your family and the family of your ancestor should go in and out before me forever. But now, the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me shall be treated with contempt. See, a time is coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your ancestors' family, so that no one in your family will live to old age. Then in distress, you will look with greedy eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed upon Israel, and no one in your family shall ever live to old age." Yada, yada, yada. Chapter 2, beginning with verse 27. Thank you for that. Samuel 1, 1 Samuel. Yeah. Well, if you want, we can. I mean, we can do the flashbacks while we do Kings. When you start with Kings, you're kind of jumping midway into the story, it's like starting with the second book of a trilogy. You know, you sort of get an idea what's led up to this point, but you know, you're still kind of wading your way through. Bob, go ahead.
I want to go with a little levity in the year. You all think it's going to get any better. It isn't. I read ahead. The next one we see where a woman steals another woman's baby.
Yeah.
It's not going to get any better for a while.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the whole point of Kings, is that it is a story of epic human failure. I mean, these kings start practicing idolatry. I mean, David's already kind of there, but it just gets worse. And the covenant continues to disintegrate, and the people are absolutely faithless. And it's just a god-awful mess. Nevertheless, God continues to work out his purposes despite and through all of this human infidelity, which points to the power and providence of God. So that's a big part of it. The other part of it is, these books were composed during the exile. They're not making it up out of whole cloth. They have these oral traditions. A lot of this stuff actually happened. There was a King David. There was a Solomon. But they've been conquered. The temple's been destroyed. They've been carted off into exile. They're slaves. They have no idea what the future holds in store for them. And they're asking themselves, how the hell did this happen? We're God's chosen people. It doesn't feel like that right now. And how could God do this to us? And so the message of these books, and especially the message of the prophets, is God didn't do this to you so much as you did it to yourselves. And this is your punishment. You know, God was very patient with you. Generation after generation, he didn't smite you down. He sent you warning after warning, prophet after prophet. You ignored them all. And so God figured, well, the only way the message is going to get across is to take them out to the woodshed. And then they'll listen. Then they'll pay attention. And they did. You know, to retain their cohesion as a people, their religious identity, they've got no temple. They're in a pagan environment, so they're like, let's write this down and let's start taking this seriously, and let's write down what we remembered about the prophets, or the few prophets who actually did write stuff down. Let's take another look and see what hope there might be, because we are still alive, and so maybe this is just a temporary thing. And let's see, what we can learn from what we've done so that maybe in the future we can be better. And if we repent, maybe God will relent and send us back to the promised land, which eventually God does. So this is people taking a fearless self-inventory as a nation, trying to figure out how they got to this point and trying to discern God's hand at action in the midst of it. Judy, you had something? And then somebody else had their hand up. Fofo, I think.
Years ago, I heard Vernon Mosher speak, and she gave an overview of the Old Testament, and that's when I stopped fearing the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. Listening to her give this broad overlook, and one of the things she, that I remember so vividly was, we want a king. You don't want a king.
Yeah.
We want a king.
Yeah.
You don't want a king. He want a king.
Yeah.
Very well, you can have a game. I remember that so vividly from her saying that. But she gave us this wonderful overview that really allowed you to see that this was a history of the people and their learning and their failings and God's mercy.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you have to let your children make their own mistakes in order for them to really come to grips with the consequences of poor choices. And God allows this. I mean, Israel having a king was not God's idea. The people wanted to be, and this was really their besetting sin. They were chosen to be special, but they didn't want to be special. They wanted to be like everybody else, and everybody around them had a king. You know, it's like these designer clothes, you know. So everybody else had a king. They wanted a king. And it's kind of understandable because it wasn't a really secure or workable situation. These 12 tribes were in confederation. And they had the judges, you know, to try to mediate disagreements between the tribes and within the tribes. But as we all know, you don't always get your problems solved through mediation. You have to go to a higher and more definitive authority sometimes in order for justice as you perceive it to be done. And so people wanted a king. And of course God foresaw that this was a bad idea and communicated this to the people through his prophet. And they kept whining and begging and finally said, okay, God said, fine, you want a king? Have a king. And he said, you know, this guy is going to exploit you. You're going to be miserable. You're going to be a lot less free, you know, so you're going to gain something. Yeah, maybe, but you're going to lose a lot more. And to me, reading the Old Testament, and especially these historical books, I mean, I think maybe we could agree the world is a mess. And there's never really been a time when the world hasn't been a mess. It always has been to one degree or another. Sometimes we're just not aware of the mess. Especially if we're benefiting from the mess. And we might disagree on why the world is a mess and what the right way to fix it is. But when we look at this, I mean, to me, there's a measure of comfort. And this is a mess. This is a right royal mess. But God's still working through it. And even when the worst happens, and you lose in the biggest of all possible ways, God is still with you working out his purposes. And there's always the prospect of redemption, always the prospect of return from exile. That's what we learn from this. That's what we have to hold on to. Fofo. Oh, I thought somebody else had their hand up. Okay, so I'm hallucinating now. This is great. What did you put in this coffee, Peter?
I don't know. The beans were from somewhere.
Well, as much as people say, oh, the God of the Old Testament is a God of wrath, it's really an expression of his immeasurable grace.
Oh, yes.
And that's the whole picture.
I mean, she said that even though we view the God of the Old Testament as wrath, God's love can be expressed in his wrath. And I think the easiest way to see that is when he liberated the Hebrews from their slavery in Egypt. God's wrath was terrible. The 10 plagues, I mean, that's awful. I mean, from our perspective, we're cheerleading for the Hebrew people, and for Moses, you're like, yeah, you know, you take that, Pharaoh. But try to imagine yourself as your ordinary, everyday Egyptian, okay? And, you know, yeah, maybe in some small way you benefit from Pharaoh's policy of oppressing the Hebrews, but you're just trying to get on with your daily life. You're just trying to brew your beer, okay? And all of a sudden, you can't get the water to brew your beer because the Nile is full of blood. And then the frogs come, then the locusts. And, you know, there gets to be a point. I mean, just try to put yourself in their shoes. And so one person's wrath is another person's love. And sometimes it can be both. Sometimes it can be both. You know, because God's wrath was very heavy upon the Hebrew people after they escaped Egypt because they made some very cowardly choices. Instead of taking the short way and just marching on into the promised land and trusting that God would allow them to take it over, they were reluctant. They hesitated. They chose not to. So they have to wander for 40 years in the wilderness. They worshipped a golden calf, and they were punished for that, so that they wouldn't spend their lives in futility worshipping a golden calf that wasn't going to get them anything. It wasn't going to get them anywhere. Okay. Sometimes being nudged along the right path requires a swift kick to the keister, you know, and that don't feel good, but it's better than going to a place where you really don't want to go and not finding out until it's too late. Peter?
Did you have a little thought for the good citizens of Jericho? What did they do to get in the way of the Israelites?
Nothing. They were just there.
They were just slaughtered.
Yeah. I mean, they probably weren't even aware that this was... I mean, it's not like there were signs like, you know, you see these signs in the movies, danger, minefield. It's not like there were all these signs around this promised land area saying, keep out or someday God's chosen people will come in and slaughter you all. The people of Jericho were just going about their business. I mean, they weren't even politely asked to leave. They just started, you know, marching around the city, making a lot of noise. Joshua in particular, it is my least favorite book of the Bible by far, because it is the one that creates the biggest theological problems for me. I don't want anything in Joshua to be true, and I haven't yet found a way to legitimately work my way around it.
But he invented Shin Bet.
Hmm?
He invented the Shin Bet, didn't he, Joshua? Spies, the Israeli spy system.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, Joshua was a great general. I mean, you got to give him that. He didn't accomplish anything without God's assistance. We've got about 5 more minutes.
You said that Between Kings is like getting into the second part of the trilogy. I mean, some said, would we be better doing Samuel?
Well, how do you guys feel about that? I mean, I'm willing to, you know, switch it into reverse. I don't think we'll lose the transmission on the road, but...
I think I would like to go back to
Okay. Okay.
Before we go to the
king. So, okay, well, why don't we just take a vote and, you know, who wants to go back and cover Sammy first? Just raise your hands. Okay. Who wants to stick with Kings? Okay. Who doesn't care? Okay. Okay. Does anyone have a quarter?
Would you go back to 1 Samuel, or would you start
with 2? I'd go back to 1 Samuel. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not going to hurt us. I mean, we're not in any hurry.
Yeah, I mean, we've been plugging along. How long has this Bible study been in existence? 12 years, 13 years, something like that. Okay. Well,
Do you feel it would be better for us to go back? I mean, you at least have the right that decision. The rest of us are sitting here.
I mean, I think, yeah, I think it's better to start with Samuel and then work your way through Kings.
Maybe you can skim through it.
Well, yeah, I mean.
But then we can refer back. Once we've been Samuel, then we can say, remember back there.
No, Samuel. We've already done Genesis. We've already done Genesis and Exodus. If you ever want to do Leviticus or Numbers, the bribe will be substantial. And, you know, if you ever want to do Joshua, I'll be referring you to a psychologist. Yeah, Judges ain't pretty either. So we'll start with an introduction in first chapter on 1 Samuel next week, and work our way through that, and then we will push our way through Kings. We won't do Chronicles because Chronicles duplicates a lot of the material in Samuel and Kings, and so to do that essentially would be for comparative purposes because there are some substantial differences. So why don't we finish off by saying the Lord's Prayer together? I'll see you next week.